Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Hello and good evening. Welcome to today's program with PEN America CEO, Suzanne Nossel. I'm Jasmine Darznik, a novelist and a professor of English and creative writing at California College of the Arts and a great admirer of PEN America. I'm pleased to be the moderator for today's program. I am joining you today from Marin County, just outside of San Francisco. Suzanne is the author of the new book, Dare to Speak, Defending Free Speech for All, and the CEO of PEN America, which uses the written word and literature to protect free expression and human rights in the United States and around the world. At this challenging time in American history, as the country juggles numerous domestic crises that tear at our civic fabric, I can't think of a more timely and important topic to discuss than freedom of speech and a more inclusive public culture. These topics aren't easy to talk about, and I'm very glad that we have Suzanne here to guide us through some of them. Suzanne, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So I am here to talk about your new book, which is, sun's beaming down, but absolutely fantastic. And I had not really seen a book like this, and I'm so grateful for its appearance at this moment. We're going to be talking mostly about the book, but I thought, actually, I first wanted to ask you about PEN America. I immigrated from Iran, so I know of PEN really through its work with writers around the world. Of course, I've paid attention greatly to the work they've done inside of Iran in the Middle East. And I just wonder if you could tell us, historically, what has that nexus been between PEN's work in outside of the U.S. and within the U.S., and how has that changed over time?
Yeah, sure. Well, thank you for asking. And it's sort of a timely question for you to pose, because right now we're in the middle of a fierce campaign for Iranian writer and human rights lawyer Nasreen Sotoudeh, who's been on hunger strike for more than a month and is sort of in grave danger in terms of her health and survival. She's protesting the fact that Iranian prisoners under the COVID crisis, ordinary criminals by and large, have been given leniency and allowed to leave prisons, on a health dispensation, but political prisoners such as herself are being held in unsafe, unsanitary conditions, vulnerable to the pandemic. And she's protesting for the release of all political prisoners. And we've been doing a petition campaign and engaging a lot of high level people like Samantha Power and Hillary Clinton to speak out right now on her behalf, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. So that work that you speak of, that's sort of the traditional heart and soul of PEN on behalf of imperiled writers around the world who are punished harshly for speaking their minds, continues apace. And, you know, if anything, in this climate of resurgent authoritarianism around the world, there's more of it to do in more places, in places where we didn't used to have to do as much work, including Turkey and the Philippines. But we have adapted our mission. We've always done some work on the United States, although I'd say PEN America, you know, by and large, was a group of writers here in the United States who felt they needed to speak out on behalf of those around the world who suffer for what we here in this country have historically done freely. But 4 years ago, it became increasingly apparent that so many of the values that we stand for as an organization really were coming into jeopardy here at home in our own country. And so we have recalibrated our mission. While we continue all of our international work, we have also focused on issues of press freedom here in the United States, the crisis in local news with so many news outlets across the country shutting their doors or slashing their newsroom staffs because of the loss of advertising revenue, issues like just today issuing a statement about the criminal prosecution now lodged against not just John Bolton for his book about his experience as the White House National Security Advisor, but also with subpoenas to Simon & Schuster and to his agent. We've also have a robust program focused on free speech on college campuses, where we worry about a rising generation that is increasingly alienated from the idea of free speech. And that's sort of what gave a lot of the inspiration for this book. So I encourage listeners to take a look at our website, penn.org, and get involved. Become a Penn member if you aren't already, because our agenda is big and we need all the help we can get.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So interesting. It certainly feels that these issues have felt increasingly an issue here in the United States. And I feel, you know, a kind of horror of recognition in seeing the increasing sort of atmosphere of intolerance around free speech here in the United States. I want to talk about your book mostly, as I said. Let me start out by asking kind of big question is why this book now?
Sure. I mean, it does go back to these conversations that we have had at college campuses across the country over the last few years, where we've become increasingly concerned about a climate of censoriousness. And we see this in incidents like protests over people like Condoleezza Rice being invited to give commencement speeches and having to pull out because there is such a climate of hostility toward their presence that they can't even go through with the appearance deliver message to students. Students calling for trigger warnings on syllabuses that alert them to material that may be uncomfortable or induce some kind of trauma. Safe spaces, the idea that some students have advocated that the campus should be an environment where people are protected from ideas that may make them feel, you know, they would call it unsafe. I would think of it more as uneasy or put into an awkward position or uncomfortable. And we began to hear more and more about those arguments being made on campus and clashes that were happening at places like Yale and the University of Missouri over these issues. And as we went around, you know, and our instinctive response, I'd say, as a free speech organization was, you know, this is pretty outrageous. You know, these students are turning their backs on the very role of a university as an environment for the free flow of ideas. You know, college is supposed to be the place where your notions get tested. You know, you're staying up all night debating with your dorm mates or in the college dining hall with that give and take, confronting people from all sorts of backgrounds and ideologies. And why are these students backing away from that and regarding it as something uncomfortable, cringe-inducing, as opposed to, you know, a robust, energizing part of their education? And so that was our instinctive response. But then as we went around to college campuses and did workshops at places like Middlebury and UC Berkeley, where there have been major outbreaks of violence in those two instances, UVA Charlottesville, we heard something pretty different that made a big impression on me, which is really that for most of these students who resort to calls for bans or punishments on speech, their real objective is not to curtail freedom of expression. That's not what they're after. What they're after is a more equal, inclusive, anti-racist and just society. And they're struggling with how to bring that about. How does the campus become a truly welcoming environment for students from all backgrounds? How do students from non-traditional backgrounds, whether racial background, socioeconomic background, and international background, make their way in institutions that were made for white, cisgender men many, many decades ago? And I think that drive for inclusivity is admirable. To me, it's sort of the next phase of the civil rights movement. And now as a society, we're seized with this. It's what's driving the protests in the streets of our cities. But it can sometimes cross over into censoriousness. And what we found is that students kind of barely know where those boundaries lie. And they are not focused on the free speech implications of, for example, a call to discipline a professor who may say something offensive in class. They haven't thought through the risks of that, the fact that that power may someday be turned against somebody that they agree with or used to silence their own protest or demonstration on campus. And those issues really, I think, are a microcosm of the struggle we're having as a society with how to reconcile the essential drive toward the next phases of equity and inclusion for our society as a whole with the robust protections for free speech that are enshrined in the Constitution and that, in my view, are a really essential part of who we are as a country and as a people. And so what I lay out in the book are 20 principles for how we can live together in our diverse, digitized, and divided society without resorting to curbs on free speech.
It's a fantastic book. I teach as an educator. I'm very grateful for a book like this. I think it's a good moment, too, for us all, you know, whether we're undergrads, to get a bit of a primer almost on what free speech is. I'm really intrigued by the structure of the book. So my expectation might be that I would enter into the book with an examination of the legal history of the First Amendment, but it's not organized like that. It's organized in a way that I appreciated very much as someone who's a citizen and active, you know, sort of curious about what I might do and how I might enter into, as you're talking about, a more inclusive and yet robust exchange of ideas. So could you tell us a little bit about how you chose to structure it the way you did, what those four parts are, and why you laid them down in that particular order?
Yeah, sure. And it was sort of a debate that I had. And I do lay out in the book, what the legal underpinnings are of free speech protections in this country, what the exceptions are to the First Amendment, because I think that's important to know as one engages in these debates. But actually, it comes sort of toward the end of the book. And I begin with, I divide the book into four sections of principles to consider when you're a speaker. So when you're voicing your own views and opinions, when you're a listener, when you're considering free speech issues, and when you're debating free speech policy questions. And I offer a set of considerations for each scenario. And I began with the speaker and the very first principles about being conscientious with language, really because I was thinking about that target audience of people who have become alienated and skeptical of the idea of free speech and who are not interested in reading, you know, a treatise on Oliver Wendell Holmes and, the doctrine of incitement to imminent violence and what it means to shout fire in a crowded theater. To young people, particularly today, you know, that can seem quite remote. When we have done programs on campus, we've actually been advised not to use the term free speech in the title of the program. Don't call it free speech because they won't show up. That is something they consider it a conservative kind of right-leaning cause. They don't consider it relevant to their social justice goals. And I wanted to frame this in a way that would speak to those who harbor those doubts. And so talking about conscientiousness with language and the idea that as a speaker, you have an obligation to think about who's in your audience. I mean, it's sort of a funny situation talking with you right now, because the fact is, I have no idea who's in our audience. We can't see our audience. We don't know, how old are people? You know, what are the races or ethnicities of people? Are there men, women? We know none of that. But what I urge in the book is, you know, whether you're posting on social media or writing articles or speaking in front of a classroom or on television, to try to give some thought to the breadth of people that might be in your audience and how they may react to what you say. So if you're talking about a particular community, disability, understand how they like to refer to themselves and what kinds of metaphors or images may be considered objectionable or retrograde. I talk about, you know, the whole progression of how we talk about people with mental disabilities and this kind of euphemism treadmill where over time, different terms, you know, years ago was terms like imbecile that, you know, become very offensive and freighted with negative associations. And then they get replaced with terms that are more neutral, you know, that sometimes in some instances themselves over time kind of take on those negative connotations. But it's something that as speakers in a world where our speech is so often decontextualized, we're communicating via the internet, people may not know who's doing the speaking, they may not see the quote in any kind of context in terms of the give and take in which whatever you've said may have come up. And people can reach snap judgments. And so it's important to have that conscientiousness. And that's where I began the book.
So just to pause here a moment, I thought the book was very practical. I really appreciated sometimes you have charts even, or many, many examples of specific instances where, as you say, words have evolved or devolved in our language and the care we ought to take in our everyday lives in how we speak to one another. As a writer, I feel like I belong to a tribe that's really attentive to language, but I have a fear myself, and I know that it exists in many of my writer colleagues and friends and students, that we have become perhaps over conscientious about our language. And I'm thinking about instances like the debacle around American Dirt. That was just one instance. That I suppose you could construe as a kind of silencing when a writer is essentially shoved off and into kind of oblivion because her identity in some way is objectionable. We don't think that it's the right person to tell the story. And I wonder what you made of that episodes like it, and the lessons that we as writers, and maybe also by extension publishers, ought to extract from these moments where there's a real calling out or a canceling of a writer for one reason or another.
I mean, the American Dirt incident happened after the book had gone to press, but I do talk about the issue that it raises of, you know, what people call cultural appropriation, or the idea that a writer who does not themselves come from a particular background decides to tell a story of people from that background. The case of American Dirt, and a white writer with a Puerto Rican grandmother, but who told a story about an undocumented Mexican immigrant. And it was a major book. She had all sorts of blurbers. It was a big release. And she was hammered by Latinx writers who argued that she had no business writing this story, and in some instances faulted the way that she portrayed her characters and the depiction that she gave of the culture that she was writing about. And she, you know, responded that she had done a great deal of research, and there were many people who stood by the book as a just riveting page turner and a very moving account of a community and an experience that doesn't get enough attention. And to me, the issues that raised are really inextricably linked with the barriers that have faced writers of color as they have sought opportunities to be published and gain the support of the publishing and entertainment industries for their stories. And, you know, historically, if you look, and there are some tabulations of this, although they're really incomplete. In the children's book area, there is an annual report that is published about how many stories there are by authors of color about characters of color. And the numbers are beginning to climb up, but they have lagged very far behind the representation of these communities within American society. And so there is a systemic pattern of exclusion that has affected these writers. And I think it's a very legitimate complaint. And I also view it as a free expression issue. I talk in the book about how the obstacles that stand in the way of people from particular backgrounds being able to participate fully in our discourse, whether that's in journalism, in book publishing, in magazine writing, in entertainment, those are to me, stand in the way of free expression. If we believe that free expression ought to be an open marketplace of ideas, that means everybody, has an opportunity to play into that. And if people do not, or their opportunities are impaired in some way, that to me is a constraint on free expression. So I think that's a major issue that the publishing industry must confront. And it's manifesting itself in this, kind of resentment toward white writers, and it's not always even a white writer. Sometimes, there are other types of cultural appropriation that people accuse writers of porting over into a culture not their own. And, my view is ultimately writers need to be able to tell whatever stories they want to. I mean, the whole premise of literature and the power of literature is that it's a portal by which you can enter into a life that's not your own and sort of inhabit a world that you would never personally experience and be inside the head of someone who is fundamentally different from you. And the writer is the emissary, the conduit. And I think to close off the writer's freedom of imagination and say, you're an Iranian American writer. You may only tell the story of an Iranian American woman immigrant. You can't tell the story of a man. You can't tell the story of somebody who's born here in the United States. You can't set a story in France or South Africa. I think would be incredibly inhibiting and just impoverish the range of stories available to all of us and make the life of a writer much less interesting and free and deter people from entering into the endeavor. And so I think that's very destructive, but I think those calls, come from a place of great frustration in terms of the failure to confront these barriers. And until there is a more systemic effort to address them, I think these resentments are going to persist and these debates are going to protract.
Yeah. I mean, they've reached, as with has every difficult subject, these debates are not new. They've just reached a fever pitch, it seems, in the current climate. And that brings me then to think about the section of the book where you're examining the principles of listening and thinking about what constraints perhaps there ought to be on free speech or free expression in instances where it's used or usurped to advance hate speech or in fact justify behavior or conduct that is hurtful. So that's a question, is how do we draw that line between, offering this expansive, robust exchange of ideas and protecting groups that have been historically, perhaps particularly vulnerable to these abuses.
Yeah, look, here the United States has the most protective standard for hate speech of pretty much any jurisdiction in the world. In Europe and in Canada, you can, and they have, banned things like Holocaust denial, the idea of incitement to discrimination. So language that is denigrating against people based on a group identity can be banned and punished by the government. Here, under the First Amendment, that's not allowed. That doesn't mean hate speech should be considered acceptable or permissible by any means. And I think one of the reasons we are in such a fraught moment in terms of free speech is that over the last 4 years, there has been a erosion of the taboos that used to play some role, never perfect, but in protecting against hateful speech. And we've seen kind of an endorsement of hateful speech at the highest levels of our government from the president, who demeans immigrants, women, people of color, people on the basis of religion, even disability. And what that has done in society, I think, is make a lot of us feel, myself included, that we need to do more to protect people from the impact of this hateful speech that is being spewed from the high from people in positions of authority. And so the impulse to then police smaller spaces, whether it's a campus, a classroom, you know, a magazine that you're part of, an organization, and be quite intolerant of noxious speech in those contexts intensifies, because it's an effort to sort of correct against something that is seen as harmful and spreading throughout our society as a whole. Now, in terms of dealing with hate speech, I think it's a serious issue, and I devote a whole chapter to the harms of speech, because I think it is the case that free speech defenders historically have been a bit reluctant to fully acknowledge those harms for fear that doing so would open the door to censorship and constraints on speech. I think that's the wrong attitude. I think as free speech defenders, we have to own up to the fact that particularly where hateful speech and messages are pervasive, so somebody who's lived their whole life being on the receiving end of racial slurs or being, you know, treated as if they're the hired help at a setting where, you know, they've come as a student or as a professor or, you know, been subject to stereotypes, that kind of thing. And it's, you know, I cite research in the book, you know, can be incredibly damaging psychologically, to academic performance, and even physiologically. So I think we have to come to grips with that. I call on free speech defenders to fight against hateful speech and hate crimes. But what I don't subscribe to is the idea that we'd be better off if we gave our government greater leeway to ban and punish hateful speech. And I feel like this administration is the perfect illustration of that, because if they weren't constrained by the First Amendment, you know, and Donald Trump had the leeway to punish hateful speech, you know, what is his idea of hateful speech? It's criticism of him. And so affording him that authority would be, in to my mind, incredibly dangerous. And you know, people may have a vision of, you know, some magical version, combination of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Thurgood Marshall and Barack Obama, you know, who would adjudicate where the boundary lies in terms of what is hateful speech. But the reality is it would be courts and judges and prosecutors, and affording them that discretion could be incredibly confining and open the door to misuse. And in my view, the greater the power that government has to police speech, the more likely that they will use it to serve their own prerogative. So I'm just very wary of that solution, but I do acknowledge that hate speech poses a serious problem.
It was inevitable we were going to talk about the administration. The First Amendment, of course, it applies to government intervention, not private platforms like Facebook or Twitter. How do we combat this often, well, it seems to me, often purposeful misunderstanding, which is effectively being claimed by the right wing, to somehow, you know, obscure these lines? The right to free speech is, it seems to me, the very definition of it seems imperiled.
Yeah. And look, there are really complex issues that I address in the book about how these platforms now hold dominion over such large swaths of our discourse. You know, they roll up into one the functions that, you know, used to be performed by newspapers, magazines, town meetings, you know, family photo albums, coffee clutches, you know, telephone calls. I mean, all these things that we used to do and vehicles for expression, you know, now have been kind of bound together in Facebook and Twitter and a few other platforms. And overwhelmingly, especially young people are getting nearly all of their news through those platforms. And we've seen the weaponization of speech in, you know, in many different categories, whether it's terrorist recruitment, conspiracy theories like QAnon spreading, fake news and false information about COVID-19, quackery, spurious cures. In terms of the election, the level of disinformation that is escalating right now, it poses to my mind, I think a very direct threat to our democracy. You know, I see a sort of a sowing of mistrust in society writ large. And so the idea that free speech or concerns are implicated in relation to these platforms, I think, is absolutely legitimate. And you're right that they are not subject to the First Amendment, that protects us only against encroachments on free speech by government. And one of the premises of my book that I talk about throughout is that while Americans are used to reflexively thinking of the First Amendment when you bring up free speech, you know, you sort of say free speech and an American says, oh, First Amendment. And, you know, the notion there is sort of that we can rely on lawyers and courts to figure out this stuff for us. And yet with so many of the controversies that we're talking about right now, whether it's, you know, whether a fake or doctored video of Nancy Pelosi or Joe Biden should be taken off Facebook, or whether a student should be punished for something that they say in class or a poster that they put up in the dorm room that is offensive. And these are issues that don't implicate government action at all. And yet they are governing, you know, what can and can't be said in society, what book you can publish that doesn't involve state action. And so the First Amendment doesn't have any answers for us. And that's why I sort of have issued this call to action for us as citizens, sort of saying, actually, you know, the courts have their part. And I don't want to underplay that, because there are issues. You know, this John Bolton book is one that has arisen just today, where we need to guard against government overreach in monitoring and muzzling speech. But that's not going to be enough to keep our free speech protections and civic discourse robust and open. We have to take action as individuals.
I would like you to talk more, though, about social media and what the parameters ought to be, or, you know, as you see it, Facebook and Twitter and the various platforms. Are they just passive figures in this conversation? Are they just a platform? Do you see them as needing to have a more proactive role in defining some of these parameters for us?
Yeah, look, I don't think they're just neutral, sort of blank canvases. They definitely are not. And it's because while they may be open to all sorts of user content, the structure of their business models hinges on algorithms that privilege certain kinds of communication. And very often it's the most outlandish, incendiary, engaging material that they feed off of. And, you know, that's why QAnon conspiracy theories sort of flourish online. And they also have a structure whereby you can create all sorts of private channels. They're like deep caves that are dug, you know, into our discourse, where people are communicating, in some cases conspiring, outside of public view. And it's not that great marketplace of ideas that we think of, where, you know, what you say is subject to counter speech and sees the light of day. And there's an opportunity to respond to something that's published in a newspaper or shouted out on a town square. When you're able to communicate with people all over the world in these very stealthy channels, you know, what we've seen is that some really noxious ideas can gain enormous traction with very little opportunity for other sources of contrary information to penetrate. I mean, one of the, you know, something we're dealing with right now at Pen America in relation to the election, you know, it's going to be an election cycle like no other. And we're talking to media outlets about how they're going to report on an election night where we're not going to, you know, very likely not going to have results. You know, we're all used to sort of, you wake up or you stay up late at night because you want all the races to be called. This time around, because of mail-in ballots, they won't be able to call the races. And so, you know, those mainstream news outlets have important work to do to behave responsibly in that in this context, but the fact is that there's a substantial segment of the population that no longer relies on those information sources and gets all of their news and data from social media and from channels that are exclusive and that have a very strong ideological orientation. So my view is we have to see these platforms for what they are. They exercise tremendous control over our discourse with serious implications for public health, democracy, and all sorts of other social goods. I think we see that they are, and I believe they will continue to become much more aggressive in policing content. The users are demanding it. Advertisers are demanding it. And I think increasingly we will see regulation. There's more and more bipartisan consensus on this. The Congress has become much more educated on these issues. For years, they were sort of stymied by the technical intricacies, but they finally begun to climb up the learning curve. And so I think we'll see this much more aggressive policing of content. And in my view, as an advocate of free expression, the key is that be accompanied by much more robust measures to protect free speech. So that if platforms are much more frequently flagging, demoting, deleting, and disabling content and accounts, if you are a user who believes that your post is legitimate free speech, something that should be allowed to be up there, you need a ready recourse. You need to be able to call a number, get a human being on the line, make your case, have an advocate in your corner so that your speech can be restored in real time. Otherwise, I think, putting this power and authority in the hands of social media platforms to regulate in an unfettered way what can and can't be said, poses real risks for free speech. And the other issue I would flag is transparency. And I think that's something where, while I'm generally leery of government regulation of speech, I think there is a role for federal action to force the platforms to be more transparent in terms of the types of content that they are both elevating and taking down, because we need to understand that in order to frame sound policy, both at the level of government and as individuals.
I have a question from one of the viewers, because they are out there. Which ties in perhaps to this, or takes us into a deeper examination of this topic. Is the question is whether conservative critics have a point on cancel culture. What's your opinion of that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the term cancel culture is used so elastically as to be almost useless. I mean, it's everything from kind of a Harvey Weinstein or a Bill Cosby, where I think, most of us could agree, look, these people have committed egregious criminal conduct, and it's perfectly fair, perhaps, not to want to associate with them or watch their movies or television shows. To, on the flip side, somebody who makes a bad editorial decision, puts out an ill-considered tweet, says something questionable in the classroom, and is confronted with calls for discipline, removal, firing. And there's an incident at Skidmore College that we're dealing with this week, where a professor attended a rally on behalf of the police. And it's not even clear that he wasn't a participant in the rally. He may have just been sort of an onlooker checking out what was going on, but he was seen there. And there's now a movement to boycott his classes. And there've been calls by students to get him fired from his position at the university. And the university sort of issued this rather tepid statement in response, which we criticized. And, I think when it comes to that kind of thing, that's where, to me, cancel culture really can go too far. And I spell out in the book, I have a whole kind of chapter devoted to sort of conscionable call outs, because I think there is a place absolutely for rejecting and speaking out against noxious expression. And, you know, we talked a few minutes ago about hateful speech. And when someone uses a racial slur or says something that is degrading, it is important to speak out. It's important that people who are victimized by that feel the sense of support. It's important that the speaker hear back that this is not acceptable, that people are not just going to be silent and look the other way. But it depends on what the right way to do it depends on the circumstances. There are some circumstances where you could do what I refer to in the book. I mean, it's not an original coinage, as a calling in, which is essentially approaching someone privately to say, hey, you know, your phrasing in the email was sort of problematic. It might be seen as dismissive to women or to a particular community. You might want to consider rewording that, or, you know, your last tweet, you know, really rubbed me the wrong way, and here's why. And, you know, if you think the person might be receptive, if they're not a serial offender, if you believe the offense was unintentional, that call-in can be a much more effective, less confrontational way to respond that doesn't put the person into a defensive crouch. You know, there are other situations where I think a public call-out is warranted, and where even canceling somebody is warranted. But we've gotten into a kind of a climate where in the minds of some, it's sort of this, the answer to all noxious speech is that the person becomes sort of permanently untouchable. And, you know, we also don't have good ways of, over time, you know, even if the offense is relatively minor, you know, it can carry this lasting stigma. It's not like, you know, you're canceled for 6 months and then it expires and you're back in good graces. It can be sometimes difficult to work your way back.
Yes, yes. No, you talk about these instances of, it's a kind of radical punishing, I think you call it. I'm forgetting the exact phrasing, but these almost ritualized, ostracizing, you know, of a member of the tribe, and the way back is completely foreclosed then to the offending party.
Yeah, and there's a, you know, there is this performative aspect to it, you know, where, you know, I think particularly kind of at a moment where we are, you know, amidst a very important reckoning on issues of race, you know, any questioning, you know, calling, casting into doubt whether defunding the police is the right policy, or, you know, asking a question about affirmative action can, you know, be construed as running counter to the new norms that we are driving toward as a society. And I think that's dangerous. I think we need room for people to ask questions and for policy solutions to be debated. And as important as it is that we do kind of force our way through to the next levels of anti-racism and equity and inclusion, I don't think that needs to or should imply that, you know, certain discourse is completely off limits, or that people will be ostracized for raising particular points. Look, there's some ideas that I think we could all agree, you know, really have sort of no place in the, you know, in our modern conversation, if it's, ideals of racial supremacy. But, you know, there are other things I talk in the book about, you know, subjects that are difficult to discuss, including, racial differences when it comes to medicine. You know, there's a kind of real leeriness to even probe those questions because of, you know, where it can go and sort of the history of how those ideas have been misused. And I think that caution is well founded, but I also point to some of the, you know, very tangible medical reasons why these lines of inquiry should not be off limits, and to some scientists and doctors who have found ways to talk about even these very sensitive topics kind of carefully and in ways that make clear that they reject racist or bigoted theories. I think it's important to try to hold open the space for those kinds of discussions.
So everything we're talking about, I'm imagining the election as we're moving closer and closer to that date, and then the ensuing scenario, you're alluding it to it a bit earlier, but how do these issues transforming or intensifying as we head into and past the election? What do you see on the horizon?
Yeah, look, I think we're in a very dangerous moment because we have allowed the role of facts and truth in our discourse to substantially erode. And, you know, it began, I think, in earnest, intensified around the time of the 2016 election with the rise of fake news and recognition of the levels of manipulation and disinformation that we're spreading on social media. And I think, you know, what has now settled in is just this, immense distrust. I was reading something this morning, the head of the CDC said masks may be more effective than a vaccine. And, my immediate thought was, I don't know if that's like a ridiculous statement or if maybe there's actually a point that he's making that has some validity. And I'm just going to have to wait to see if this is something that serious scientists elsewhere, repeat or respond to. Like the fact that the head of the CDC said it means nothing. And, that's kind of where we are. And someone else told a story of, being in an ER just in the last few days and asking a question about, if can you still be contagious with COVID after 5 weeks? And the ER doctor said, the CDC says X, but I don't believe the CDC. And so I think we're at a very dangerous moment when it comes to the election and the results. Who are we going to believe if it's disputed? And it will be disputed. And, we don't have, we're used to having authoritative sources in government and in the courts that we can turn to resolve these things. And it's very hard to think about, I think there's nobody really in that position. And it's a pretty kind of frightening, precarious moment where I think our grip on truth has really been loosened. I think a lot of people are alarmed about it and recognize that that's been a systemic effort. I think it relates to the president's campaign to discredit journalism and characterize reporters and media outlets as an enemy of the American people. I think that, skepticism has taken hold and that, sources like the New York Times that I certainly regard as authoritative, aren't looked at that way by significant swaths of the population. So I do think it's a dangerous moment. My hope is that the people's commitment to get to the polls is out of a recognition that we have to turn this around and that we're successful in doing that.
And we haven't talked that much about the press and the erosion of that mechanism in a sense. The slow bleeding of the local presses, the local publications. Could you talk a little bit also about journalism and what role it should play in not just the election, but in the preservation of the very notion of truth?
Yeah, look, it's extremely important. And we did a big report that we released late last year called Losing the News, that is about the crisis in local news across the country, which we framed as a crisis of democracy because and the statistics are bleak. There's been a $30 billion loss of revenue in the local news industry, and that's because advertising monies that used to go for classified and those big display ads, full page ads in newspapers now have all migrated online, and most news content is available for free on social media. And so when you see an article via Facebook, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer doesn't get a remittance back from that. And so these outlets are really suffering. More than 20% have closed their doors, and the remainder newsrooms have been slashed by an average of 50%. And what you see is that, there's just no one there to hold local officials accountable, whether it's an issue of pollution or corruption in a health department or an educational issue, the investigative reporters and beat reporters who were holding officials' feet to the fire just aren't there and are much fewer in number. And the COVID crisis, I mean, it's kind of interesting because the COVID crisis actually has sparked a greater appreciation of this unfolding sort of slow motion drying up of local news as a serious problem. Yeah, and you know, when we issued the report, we sort of thought, well, it's not until there'll be a new Congress that anybody in Washington will take an interest in this. But actually, that hasn't been true because amid COVID, local news outlets have been so important in terms of telling people what the rules and regulations are, where you can get tested, where you can get basic services, where they're accessible within the community. And so the role of local news has been underscored, and there is a lot more now concern and consternation and sort of a serious discussion in Washington about how to address this. I mean, there's no silver bullet solution, but it has catalyzed greater awareness of the crisis. So I'm somewhat more hopeful for some movement on this, but it, the other thing is local news is the most trusted news. So the distrust that has been sown, that has been sown deliberately by this White House, but that also, is partially a product of some of the ways in which news has evolved. The fact that our news outlets are more ideologically polarized, the rise of cable news, which, I think of it not as news, but as kind of talk television, the equivalent of talk radio, where so much of what sort of is positioned as news is, are really just talking heads opining with very little original reporting being offered. And yet there's a blurring of the lines between that and, actual hard-hitting news reporting. And I think that has undercut the reputation and the standing of news in the minds of many in the audience. And so I think there are some ways in which the news industry itself, bears a portion of the responsibility for this discrediting and the distrust that has arisen, but local news sort of stands out as the most trusted channel.
I have another question from a viewer that I wanted to get to as many as we could. I'm being asked to ask you, what would you do about QAnon?
Well, it's really hard. I think it's a positive step that Facebook is taking action supposedly to try to root out these communities online where the conspiracy theory is spreading. I have a concern, though, that they typically take action only when somebody reports a community, and they don't generally, particularly in these private communities, they don't generally sort of snoop in to look at, what is being said and shared. And, there's some good reasons for that. But, it also just may mean that the action that they've taken is a tiny tip of the iceberg. And, I think this is really alarming. I think people have a role in relation to those in their own lives who are spreading and subscribing to disinformation and conspiracy theories. We actually just put out a sort of tip sheet last week at PEN America about how to talk about disinformation to sort of your great uncle or your neighbor, where it's sort of awkward, but you see that they have posted something on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram that you know or suspect is bogus. And we try to outline kind of systematically how you can engage in that conversation. And like the fact is, as citizens, we have to do it. I mean, nobody is going to bring reason to these people if it's not their own family members and friends and neighbors. So, I hope some of the principles in the book about kind of how to have these conversations across difference can help people feel a sense of confidence in bringing up what is a tough conversation, because it could get contentious. And so, I think we need to equip people to broach it.
Yeah, that's something I took away very strongly from your book, and why I will be teaching it and referring to it myself is it's so very practical, and it's down to those conversations on Facebook and those posts, those awkward moments around, you know, the dinner table or the classroom. You know, we don't have classrooms anymore, but our Zoom conversations with our students.
And it's an issue. I mean, there's special issues in the virtual classroom. You know, I think in terms of the barriers to participation and who feels comfortable, you know, I noticed this in a lot of our discussions that there's a kind of, you know, sort of takes more to take the floor in a Zoom conversation. You don't have the cues and the kind of body language and, you know, the ability to sort of see that a couple people probably agree with what it is that you're going to say, so you feel empowered to speak out. And, you know, a lot of that is missing. And I do worry about who is shut out of the conversation, you know, in this virtual world, and in whether it's school rooms, classrooms, college classrooms, or beyond.
Yes, it is not, it's not a native platform to any of us. And it does in some ways exaggerate or you know, just further complicate our interactions with one another, as much as it allows them to still happen, like this conversation. Very grateful that we could meet this way, but it's so true. There are also terrible drawbacks in this. So again, thank you so much, Suzanne. This has been a really edifying conversation, and I hope someday we'll be able to welcome you into our city of San Francisco in person under blue skies, I hope. And thank you for your book. Thank you so much for your book. That's it for today's program. I could definitely talk much longer, but our time's up. Again, a reminder that Suzanne Nozzle's book, Dare to Speak, is now available wherever books are sold. I encourage you to purchase a copy. I also encourage you to continue to follow the Commonwealth Club, which has just a wealth of programming every day. You can visit Commonwealth Club at www.commonwealthclub.org and follow all the upcoming events. I am Jasmine Darznik, and this virtual Commonwealth Club program is adjourned.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you like what you've heard, please consider supporting our work and help us bring 500 programs a year to listeners like you. Go to commonwealthclub.org/donate. Think your way around the world with our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live at our events. Thank you for listening and for your support.